the shocking murder of Sir David Amess. Is it right that MPs are exposed in this way because they've become a vital link for the public who can't seem to get answers from all sorts of public services that essentially seem to have closed up shop and become a hostile environment? We look also at the NHS crisis and particularly the idea that GPs are not seeing enough people face to face. Sajid Javid is getting pelters from the profession and from the Scottish and Welsh governments. But how are GPs managing to triage their patients so the ones who really need to be seen are getting through? Those are the headlines. Now for the podcast.
Hi, chums, and welcome to this week's Leslie Riddick podcast. So, it's one of these, it's been an odd week in terms of politics and following what's going on, Leslie. And I think we've got to begin with the murder of Sir David Amess. An absolute shock to the political system, an absolute shock on a personal basis as well, because, you know, I didn't know the man, but I mean, there seems to be an outpouring of warmth towards him on a personal basis, and where politics seems to be set aside completely.
Yeah, I was actually on Any Questions on Friday night in Stirling, which rapidly changed in nature. It was going to be the normal, you know, set to, I guess. And then after the news of that murder, it rapidly, I mean, I think they had a huge discussion about whether they should go on at all, whether there should be an audience suddenly, all sorts of stuff. But in the end, they decided that they would go ahead with it, that there would be an audience. They weren't going to ask questions, which was a kind of odd-ish thing. It would just be more Chris Mason, as the presenter, was just going to go through pretty much tributes to Sir David Amess from the three MPs on the panel who knew him. And then I was kind of stuck in this then very awkward position of being the one who didn't know him personally at all. And then there was an attempt to try to widen out the discussion, which again was really, I thought, just incredibly awkward, because since we had no idea at all at that point about the nature of the person that had been arrested or any potential motive. And again, this still pertains at the moment because, you know, when somebody has been murdered like this, you know, there's many things one could raise about Sir David's various interests and political drives and motivations and so on. And yet it seems completely not the thing to do, even for people who are probably not folk who sort of worry too much about what the form is for things in the wake of something this appalling. So I think we're still stuck in that, really, that it's hard to get sort of elbow room, in a sense, to sort of consider what's happening, because every attempt to do it brings you fairly quickly into, you know, a bit of a mire. I mean, of course, it seems it's quick, you know, you wouldn't need to be a blooming genius or very controversial to point out that politics in Britain has become incredibly polarised. It was always there in the system for that to be the case, because it sits on a polarising system, as in, you know, anyone who's listening to this podcast will just be saying, do not go back in again to what First Past the Post does. But I'm afraid it creates two large constituencies, which the other. So you've got at the very heart of everything, and that's, it goes even more basic than that. Everything, you know, is basically adversarial. The legal system relies on that. The competitive funding for practically anything that's grown up over many years, actually, of Tory and New Labour government sets people all continually against one another. I see, as someone who's old enough to remember differently, TV formats are all about competition and knocking the other person out and detecting when, you know, someone's lying, you know, as a kind of victory within the form of the game. And yet, in a sense, none of that's relevant, very probably, to the motivations of the killer. You know, so it's hard. These things are all true, but it's hard to say that actually sits within the mind of someone whose motives may remain pretty unknowable and who seems you know, who seems to have had quite different views, which might be related to interventions in Iraq. Who knows? So we're currently throwing everything up in the air. The one fact would be that many MPs and public-facing people don't feel safe and aren't sure when an innocent-feeling situation is suddenly in the midst of it going to have someone who's just there with very different intent.
Yeah, absolutely. Because, I mean, I listened to Joanna Cherry talking, who's been subjected to online abuse and threats. In fact, someone was jailed because of making threats and threats in addition to of a sexual nature. Diane Abbott, I mean, I believe receives 50%. You know, one MP receives 50% of that kind of abuse. And Joanna was talking about the fact of having to consider now, for the protection of herself, the safety of her staff, doing consultations online, doing phone consultations and phone discussions with constituents and matters of importance, which would happen during the pandemic and when it was shut down, face to face wasn't appropriate. And it is that whole thing.
I think actually Scottish MPs are still there, actually. I don't know that they have actually come out of...
Right.
And I'm not sure if that's an SNP thing or a Scottish government thing or what it is, but I'm not sure how many actual surgeries there are at the moment. But the difficulty with this is that the people who most use surgeries, from the little I could glean from speaking to a couple of MP office managers, are not people who have the internet.
Yeah.
They're very often people whose lives are pretty chaotic. They could, for example, have, and this was another point made, there is a hostile environment developing in all government agencies.
Yeah.
So you try to get through, for example, on universal credit, we've been through this before, you may be unemployed or homeless, and the only way for you to make an application or amend it or deal with it is online. So you're standing, if you can get there, outside of McDonald's or somebody where you've got free internet, and hoping that you can do some sort of connection with the system before your application's timed out and you have to do it again and again and again. And this is not conducive to anybody feeling, you know, part of a system or a proper citizen. So those kind of folk will be the ones who, if they get wind that there is an actual MP in town, and see a poster, I mean, old style physical location and face to face works best for people who've actually been, even the DWP and the Social Security apparatus will actually bar you if you've been, in their minds, objectionable. Despite the fact that, I mean, if you've watched any of the films that, you know, portray the kind of frustration that arises from being dealt with like this, it's almost inevitable that any normal person would eventually begin to get quite angry being treated the way that people are currently treated and sized, graded, judged, rejected, sanctioned for being a minute late. All of that creates an angry situation, but it also means that many people are actually barred, it's unbelievable, from interacting with the part of the state that is obliged to deal with them. So if that's the case, where do you go? And actually, you might go to Citizens Advice, but MPs and MSPs have got numbers through to these places that are given to, you know, representatives, so that they do actually have a means of cutting through all that stuff. And if you look at the rate at which appeals are successful, it's in the high 70s to 80% of appeals against all sorts of bad judgments are successful, which suggests that if you've got an MP or MSP on your side as a sort of expert advocate, your chances of having something resembling a life and an income are pretty high. And if you don't, you don't. Yeah. So the difficulty with kind of shutting down this sort of lifeline is right there. And everyone who's had to deal with people who are in this kind of extreme situation will know that if people are treated badly, they begin to get guy prickly, pretty defensive and fairly awkward. maybe even present as pretty strange, which these days may well look pretty aggressive. And yet there may be nothing more wrong with them than that they have just been barred from every system for appearing 1 minute late for something.
Yeah.
And for those people who have real understanding of all of this dilemma, and that should be every MP. I mean, there was a point in the, I was trying to make these points in that Any Questions program, and Chris Mason came back at some point and said, but on the other hand, you know, this should mean that the level of casework that MPs are doing means they have a better idea of how policy is kind of landing, as it were, because they hear all of that. And I just did say to them, I did think that, but then why do we still have universal credit?
Yes.
At which the audience applauded, actually, you know, in the midst of it all. So that's the crazy thing, really. So caring MPs and MSPs are going to find it very hard for these reasons. They know they are that lifeline. Perhaps the rest of us don't realise how much they have become the paramedics.
Yes.
Of the governance system, because they're the ones that just are actually dealing with all the car crashes to a great degree. And many, many MPs realizing this have started to sort of shift their surgeries around. I'm trying to remember which speaker on that night was talking about having a wee caravan that they took around to places because they had a rural constituency. And lots of people turn up. Now, the other thing is, if there's suggestions that people should have appointments, booked in appointments. But again, that's something that pretty chaotic people just don't work with. So, you know, here we have this. It is indeed like the system, under the strain of so many different things now, is absolutely falling to pieces because it's making decent MPs have to choose between feeling better about their own security or screening out the people, the majority of whom will have no more crime behind them than having chaotic lives. And yes, let's say chaotic lives have been created consciously by this Conservative government.
And that's the point I was going to lead on to, Leslie, because I watched the Mars show, and Priti Patel spoke very warmly and movingly about the relationship she had with David Amos, who was a fellow Essex MP. And going through my head at that point, possibly uncharitably, was that seems to be a typical reaction in terms of the ability to display empathy, sympathy and warmth and care and love for someone that you know. And you feel that empathy and warmth and love when it's close to you where a disaster happens. And at that point, I was thinking about Priti Patel's policy of immunity for border force, for this turnaround tactics for refugee boats, you know, and the immunity that border force personnel would have if there was a death resulting from turnaround tactics. And I thought, I cannot square this, you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. I cannot square that within my own mind, about that ability to separate out the individual from the collective and not to display that warmth, empathy, love and care for people you don't know, when you can obviously display it for people that you do know. The second thing, I was listening to Ray McCord this morning on Good Morning Scotland, because this is another immunity which we've talked about before, which is the immunity from prosecution for pre-1998 offences committed during the Troubles in Northern Ireland. And Ray McCord directly referred to the murder of Sir David Amos, saying this was a terrorist act. And why would people feel if there was a statute of limitations in terms of a terrorist act like that? But that is being introduced in Northern Ireland against, right across the political spectrum, against the wishes of the victims who have not been consulted. And he's meeting with Boris Johnson today with the representatives of people searching for truth, justice, reconciliation for the victims of acts committed right across the board in Northern Ireland. So these are key issues here. But again, it comes back to me that ability as an individual to display empathy, but not for people you know, but to have that hard, cold attitude towards people in dire straits that they don't know.
Yeah, That's a really good point. And kind of maybe more that these, that, you know, people, that anybody they don't know just fits into a kind of category, cipher, caricature, whatever category. That's the thing. In the end, it's numbers and categories for people who sit beyond your party's desire or reach, or the vulnerable or the weak just are in a category. You know, it's, there's something really wrong with the inability to empathize with situations unless they belong, unless they're actual members of your family.
Yeah.
This is the conservative family. And I mean, whilst family ties are always obviously going to be the strongest, it's always worrying when people's sense of empathy for children, for example, stops right at their own ones. Mm-hmm. So, you know, you'd expect that public life demands more. It demands both sort of empathy. And that's where fairness comes in as well, because even if you haven't got vast amounts of empathy, if you just rely on a fair system, if the fair system is in with the bolts, bricks rather, if it's bolted in to the way that your democracy works, then it doesn't rely on whether or not you've got the capacity to feel empathetic towards people that you don't know. But it definitely looks as if that's all you've got here. The other thing I kind of raised on the night was just the having said all of that about the necessity at the moment for constituency surgeries to pick up people who absolutely will not get help anywhere else, apart, it would have to be said, from the Citizens Advice Network, which is also overwhelmed. It is a crazy reality that basically our politicians are spending time trying to fix problems with government systems and even with local government failings. You know, Andrew Bowie, who was on, was talking about the sort of stuff he does about problems with broken pavements or gyms and schools. These are local government things. In Sweden, they have an, where the word ombudsman comes from, they have an ombudsman system so that basically any faults with a system is directed to that civil servant, because it is, after all, a civil service problem. And they, there's a huge number of ombuds people for all sorts of, you know, the different functions of government. And I don't think many people would expect to bring them to their MPs, who are regarded as legislators. Pure and simple, that is what they're there for. That's what kicked off the discussion about whether or not actually you do need to know about caseload to see how policies are going down. And that's what prompted me to say, well, if that really worked as a thing, we wouldn't have universal credit. But, you know, there's surely got to be a question mark about the whole system and structure. I mean, here, you know, to be fair, you would not get elected if you were not considered to be a good constituency MP, MSP. Well, maybe you would, actually, when I think of the number of people who are pretty rubbish. But, you know, it's certainly a thing that you have to put yourself about and look like you give a toss, basically, in most circumstances. And that means spending an inordinate amount of time, which also, let's face it, this is part of what is putting the exposure to the pub, to the occasional threat, physical threat, and that workload is quite a daunting kind of thing. So at least it might be, you know, in a world where anybody worried about what the fundamental structures are, you might now beginning to question whether or not the stoked up resentment that's created from all sorts of closed doors in governance is actually directed at the only folk you can get your hands on, which is MPs. And I'm not saying, by the way, that that's what happened in the case of Sir David Amos. But I do remember, you know, back in Belfast, when it was very difficult for representatives of the British state to be reached, shall we say, because they were protected, they were armed. The people who took it in the neck were the bus drivers. They were wearing a uniform, but they looked like they were part of something. And they were the ones who had no armed guard, no protection. And they were, in a sense, almost substitute targets at times, it seemed to me. And actually, if you were to look at just the exposure across more professions, which is another point I'd wanted to make but didn't have time to make, you know, there's been a massive increase in threats and physical violence against teachers, shop workers particularly, especially because they're the ones that have to enforce the wearing of masks. These statistics that you can gain are mostly from England, and I don't know, but there seems to be, you know, a lot more pushback against mask wearing across the border, so that the shop workers' unions have been saying that their folk are just being attacked so standardly that Boots, for example, have issued all their staff with little portable sort of alarm things when they're out on the shop floor. There has been a specific law passed in Scotland to try to fix any loophole that means targeting shop staff is now a criminal offence in itself. There isn't one in England. But, you know, there's lots of people who are taking, in a sense, the collateral. I mean, police, the list is endless. Anyone who's having to deal with desperate people is now getting rage, basically. Rage right in their face.
And, yeah, and it's the... To me, I've always thought it was an odd situation where you actually, when I had to talk about the role and function of MPs and MSPs when I was lecturing, to say that they were people who actually functioned in some way like social workers. You know, they were actually sitting listening to problems and taking it up when actually what they were dealing with was putting sticking plasters on the realities of the broken system that they were talking about. And the other thing was, it always went through my head, I always find it interesting to find people talked about as good constituency MPs. Because what they're actually doing is, yeah, they're meeting with their constituents, they're taking up constituency issues, they're advocates for their local area. I get that. But as we've discovered with Douglas Ross recently, he's a member of a political party which is actually enacting, in terms of the changes to constituency boundaries, enacting things he fundamentally disagrees with. But he gets a get-out-of-jail-free card by standing up saying, I'm standing up for my constituents. I'm objecting to this. You know, I'm a good constituency MP. But the reality is it's utterly irrelevant because the political party he belongs to is in power with an 80-seat majority, and he just gets kudos for actually theoretically standing up to them, wherein in reality it's a gesture which actually makes them seem like a good constituency MP, which might actually lead us into, which was a surprising video column in the National for some people, where you actually turn around and said, well, just because Douglas Ross is a wee bit of a quiche, that's my word, doesn't mean to say he's wrong in terms of what's happening.
Well, yes, there's going to be the Boundary Commission, which is independent of government, has been trying to have a redistribution of seats to equalise the numbers for some decades, and pretty much everyone has bottled it. The first attempt was meant to happen when the Lib Dems were in power, but they refused to go along with it because the Tories wouldn't do House of Lords reform. The second attempt was Theresa May, and she knew she wouldn't get it through the House of Commons because it would mean taking the total number of MPs in the Commons from 650 down to 600. So there would be a lot of Tories that would basically lose their seats, and she was not in a powerful enough position to push through anything like that. So here we are with the third attempt, where Boris has actually abandoned the attempt to bring the Commons down to 600 because he can see how that ain't going to work. So 650 remains the total, and that's why, to an extent, it's a lot less swinging than it could have been if there'd been that deeper cut. Of course, on the face of it, you look at it, Scotland's losing 2, Wales is losing 8, England's gaining 10, and you think, see, there you are. Now, you know, there's many things you could stand back and say, but the difficulty, to my mind, is that we have to be guided by and bound by the decisions made by a commission that is not fundamentally looking at or open to any different sort of argument about how you represent very, very large but thinly populated areas. So what we have already in Scotland are some of the largest constituencies in Europe. The one that, you know, my family would be in used to be Caithness and Sutherland. It's now Caithness, Sutherland and Ross. Is half the landmass of the Highlands, which in itself is the same landmass as Belgium.
Yes.
So, you know, that is the size of constituency that we think is okay in representative terms. And I know that, you know, for Gail Ross, who I'm trying to remember now, if she had her surgery based her office, where you base your office then becomes massively important, because people who are close to that physical office re-earlier conversation, can actually come in to you and with their problems and are in to that degree super served. So I can't remember if latterly Gail was having one in Invergordon or Wick, but you see my point. Whichever mm-hmm. end of that massive constituency you were covering, the other end had a bit of a journey unless you just kept moving around, you know, which again, is that what we expect an MP to do, as well as travel to London and be an actual representative? So anyway, coming back to the Boundary Commission, what's being proposed for Big Dougie's seat is that it gets basically disappears and is split into three, which get papped onto all the neighbouring seats. Now, he makes the point, and so does Richard Lochhead from the SNP, that then means that the one council area currently that constituency maps onto Moray Council, the new proposals mean that the same folk are now split across three different councils. They're all in the one council, but they're in three different constituencies. So that is kind of really difficult. They're in constituencies which then morph you into Aberdeenshire and, you know, all sorts of different areas, which is crazy because a lot of the problems, as we've just discussed, relate to councils, which is Moray Council. So quite apart from the fact that everyone's getting split up across the piece, it's also creating another whopper of a constituency. And actually, the same is true. Ian Blackford's constituency, I think, is the third largest in Scotland, which will very probably be the third largest potentially in Europe. Although I'm thinking about this and I'm thinking, do any of the Arctic Nordic ones actually have larger constituencies? But then I would think that they would be factoring in a sort of remoteness factor to be able to make the constituency smaller. And this is the point. We can't decide that it actually just doesn't make sense to go for equal numbers in cities and rural areas. And that's what the Boundary Commission is going for. It's going for 75,000 folk on average, electors in every constituency, whether you're in very remote, depopulated areas or the centre of Glasgow. And we have no say in whether or not we'd like to put a weighting on that so that we just don't end up with these Herculean sized constituencies.
Yeah, because what I did, see, this working with you for over the number of years, Leslie, immediately what I did was I thought, how do the Norwegians cope with this? So I went and had a look at that, and they've got 19 constituencies, 169 MPs. But what they do is they elect between 4 and 20 MPs per constituency. But rather than allocation on population or electorate, what they do is they do a formula that accounts for population and area. And it's a deliberate attempt to overrepresent sparsely populated rural parts of Norway. Now, that gets criticism for doing that. But what they've done in addition to that is all but one seat in the constituency is based on that vote, but they have an additional seat, 19 adjustment seats, for parties that won 4% of the vote nationwide. And now that was done partially to compensate for that rural, urban, you know, the overrepresentation of rural. But what it also did, and I thought was incredible, was it said because the system that previously operated benefited the larger parties. Now, I cannot see any political, any Labour or the Tories introducing, or the SNP, if we get an independent Scotland, they become the government. I really cannot see, given the present thinking of any of the major political parties, anybody considering that kind of what seems to me an incredibly sensible, logical, fair way to proceed to actually represent the constituencies and not, as you say, come up with these absolutely Herculean-sized constituencies that are terrible to administer and do not represent anything coherent in terms of representation. So that the Norwegians tick the box for that one again, but it was because of you, I went think, I'll go and have a look at that. And lo and behold, it's smart.
Oh, right. Barry Bra.
Yeah.
Well, the other thing to say is on all of this is it's actually not clear either that the Tories will actually gain as much out of this as they thought they might do, because since the Tories have actually got so many red wall seats that are in old urban mm-hmm. areas of the north of England, those are precisely the places that are losing seats, whereas the Labour has actually consolidated its position within London which is gaining, as we know, population all the time. So it will probably pick up some. I mean, over the peace, the Tories will gain some seats out of this, but it's by no means the sort of complete slam dunk that it, that probably it would have been if there'd been more wholesale change. So, yeah, so there we are.
Yeah, but as I say, unfortunately, I can't see anybody enacting anything halfway as sensible as the Norwegians have done. But that just shows the flaws that are and the ideologies.
But that's because they're using proportional representation.
Yes, yeah, I know.
See, it keeps coming back to that, and I'm sure everyone goes, "God, I'm just so fed up hearing about it." But this one thing is what creates, is what feeds. It doesn't create because it was chosen, and people keep choosing not to change it. So it comes from a place and an outlook which just keeps wanting majoritarian rule and doesn't care that that leaves people completely without any say in government for decades. And the people who think that that's all right and want to play that game, and that includes Labour at the moment, it's baffling to me how anybody thinks you can actually undo all these bad outcomes and feel, you know, just the resignation that we're a half-hearted, archaic democracy trying to sound a little bit modern. That's what it adds up to. And it just baffles me that, you know, people don't realize this one needs to change. But anyway, twas ever thus.
Twas ever lost. And thinking about twas ever lost, Dr. Sandesh Gulhani, the Conservative spokesperson in Scotland on health services, was on this morning talking about the introduction of what he continually referred to as the British military. There you go. Twas ever lost in that sense. I think it's three health board areas now to try and cope with the difficulties that are arising, which the health board themselves has been down completely to the problems with COVID. Now, whether that's he demurred on that one, and he turned around and it was he turned around and was questioned by Laura Maxwell. She says, "Well, you say that it's dreadful that they're being brought in to be used up here in Scotland, but what about England?" And she went through all that, and he tried to dodge it on by saying, "Ah, well, I don't think patients in Scotland really care about this." And he said, and this was the clincher for me, he said, "But what I'm saying has been wrong is the Scottish government, the SNP government, as you can refer to them as, didn't bring the military in soon enough. So the fact that the English system had to bring in the military back in August to cope with issues was a good thing because they actually spotted the problem earlier." And that kind of leads me into, I thought it was a very significant article that you wrote. And again, it's about the impact of us on individuals in terms of GP services, because I know both you and I are very dependent upon that, particularly on my grandson Oscar, who was whipped into A&E again on Saturday, and the GPs have been absolutely fantastic with him and getting that service again because of his asthma and his allergies. And you yourself said that you've received terrific service from GPs. But there seems to be a narrative developing, which you analysed, in terms of the Conservative government now switching and fundamentally turning around saying to Sajid Javid, saying, "We're keeping our eyes on you, you GPs, because you haven't been doing the job that we've been asking you to do." But as with everything else, it's a heck of a lot more complex than Mr. Javid is making out.
Well, you know, the way I've been sort of looking at this is Sajid Javid's suggestion that GPs are avoiding face-to-face appointments. Now, first of all, it was the British government that actually insisted that there should not be face-to-face appointments during COVID, and in fact, even till quite recently. But I think there's a feeling now, and of course, it's different across the whole country, that you cannot get to see a GP if you actually need to. And that is causing people some sense of alarm. Now, this would be different across different GPs for the reason that GPs are essentially independent contractors and are not employed directly by NHS boards. GPs are the only health professionals who are like that. So they cannot be essentially told to do stuff, although there's guidelines that most GPs operate by. But there's a lot of discretion in how they staff up, how they deal with triage, for example, And this, I think, is a pretty important point, because whilst I cannot praise my own GP, and in fact, I've had two Fife GPs, and they've both been beyond fantastic. So, you know, I've had no difficulties there. And I do need to see a GP quite regularly because I have a monthly blood test for the autoimmune problem I've got. But see, there's the thing, because I probably wouldn't know then how much someone who doesn't have that kind of almost, you know, joker card actually fares in trying to see a GP with anything, quote, ordinary. And this is the rub, because Sajid Javid's saying 250 million quid for English doctors to provide more staff, as long as you get your face-to-face appointments quotient right up and see the 20% of GP surgeries practices across England that are at the bottom of that league. So he's already done all of this. They will be named and shamed in a list that publishes who has the least face-to-face appointments. So not unsurprisingly, this has kind of provoked a storm amongst GPs south of the border. And since they tend to be, you know, organised within royal colleges that are, you know, that fairly connect them across the whole of Britain, this is something that's agitating GPs, I think, everywhere. But anyway, although I should say very quickly, the Scottish Government and the Welsh Government have completely disowned this approach and say they have got no intentions to do strings attached or shame, name and shaming lists or any of that sort of stuff. But nonetheless, the question still remains about whether or not people who really need to get in to see a GP are actually getting triaged to get in. Now, I know from my own personal experience of two people, one, neither of whom was able to get into surgeries, which were regarded locally and widely regarded locally as equivalent to Fort Knox in terms of you could not get into them. One of them finally was found to have pneumonia on going to hospital, and the other one was found to have lung cancer at a fairly advanced stage after getting into hospital. And I'm pretty sure these examples are not uncommon. Macmillan Healthcare are saying, oh, there was 50,000, I think, missed cancer diagnoses last year. That will be continuing. And that, how is that being triaged? It's really important that the journey starts as quickly as possible. And if people are getting the impression that they can't get into the, you know, place they're used to going when they've got something wrong, which is their GP, they will put off until they have such bad symptoms that they finally go to A&E. And then that brings us to the rest of the picture. A&E is absolutely overcrowded because partly so many people are bypassing GPs they cannot see face to face. Now, again, triage, you know, A&Es are full of people that have got all sorts of stuff going on Friday and Saturday nights are the same as they ever were, by and large, with people who are also potentially cancer patients sitting in the wings waiting to be seen or not seen. I know again of one case where someone pitched up on Friday night with very severe symptoms and was actually sent to another hospital in Edinburgh because they were full up with people who were drunk. So we have got massive problems with the way that things are working at the moment. So just to come back to the GPs, one practice in Ayrshire has admitted that it's using, quite often, it's doing automatic call diversion of all calls to a central Ayrshire urgent care centre. And who knows how that gets staffed and what happens there, because it's getting 500 calls a day compared to 150 pre-pandemic with the same staff. And then if we're just looking at the numbers, or fewer, because actually, whilst there's been constant promises by all governments in Scotland and Westminster to increase the numbers, actually, the numbers of GPs in Britain are just falling. So there's about 900 short in Scotland, and at least 5,000 short in England, but that was the pledge. There was going to be 5,000 more to fix the gap probably 5 years ago. So we could be well short. We've got workplace staff shortages in absolutely every department, from nursing to GPs to, if anyone was watching an excellent documentary last night on Channel 4, The Dispatches, clapped out, you know, is the NHS broken? It was gobsmacking in its turn, right through every different thing, whether it was different kinds of staff, we're at the bottom of every league table, different kinds of kit, particularly kit, really important kit like CT scans, we're at the bottom of every country in Europe. Every single aspect of healthcare, we are at the bottom of everything. We're below everybody in Europe. So, you know, we've got difficulties created by underinvestment generally. And then we do have an issue of it being hard to deal with this at the moment because health boards can't quite shunt around GPs to fill the gaps where they occur because, you know, going back to that one, they're not directly employed by the NHS. They're independent contractors. So, for example, when you get areas that have got population growth, huge new estates built, they might be slow to get the doctors that they need for that because the existing practices can't be made to move and can't be made necessarily to open up their lists to include those new people. If they do and they don't staff up properly because there's a shortage, they will end up having far, far too many people per GP. So what the Scottish government seems to have been doing, and the British one to an extent, is trying to kind of create a new situation where there are primary care hubs. So there are more non-GP health practitioners in there sharing the load. I think everyone will have got used to, if you go in for a flu jag or a blood test or a blood pressure or a smear test, you're not going to see a GP now. You're going to see an advanced nurse practitioner. And there's various other allied professionals in these hubs so that the GPs are doing less of the things that take some of the time. And actually, there's been some pioneering stuff where there's one practice, a series of practices called the Deep End GP Network, which cover the 100 most deprived populations in Scotland. And they've got a community links worker program. So they're connecting patients that might have anxiety, mental health issues, postnatal depression, with community organizations as well as third sector stuff. So that actually, these hubs are also creating new salary GPs who for the first time since the health service began in Inverness actually this way are salaried and directly employed by the NHS. They don't have all the responsibility that comes with managing a practice. That is a centrally governed thing. But, you know, they're there and they can be deployed in the same way that other staff can be deployed, which means workforce planning gets a heck of a lot easier. Now, you know, it's not a big thing yet. There's only 55 GP practices of the total. That's just 6% of the total that are salaried. So it's not a big thing yet. And the question is, though, there's a bit of public pushback because everybody just wants to go to what they were used to, which is a GP that's possibly just one or two of them sitting on their own somewhere in a, you know, wee housey, somewhere near where you live. And it may be that for city areas, the hubs are the future, partly because they help, they're a way to get around some of these workforce pressures that are just stopping people getting to see GPs at all. And when it comes to this thing of telemedicine, I mean, I can remember doing lots of programs when I was on the wireless about this because it has to be the future, particularly because if you're in flu season, you do not want to go to a doctor's waiting room. You know, I mean, surely now we realize that, you know, if you can be kept out of hospitals and doctors' waiting rooms, that's the best way to maintain health because they're full of sick people. It was always a nonsense that there couldn't be emails used, that there couldn't be all sorts of stuff used for medicine to try to deal more quickly with stuff. You kept having to pitch up in person. And yet the key question to me is, how are doctors doing triage? Because just from the experience of my own friends, there has not been careful enough investigation of the people who really needed to be coming in. They were folk who needed to be on their health journey and referred in to consultants and so on much, much quicker. But because of this kind of overwhelm thing and because some practices are just, I think, just not good enough. And this is the other thing. Their MSPs knew.
Yeah.
So, you know, every councillor and MSP knows where they have a failing practice. And yet we don't have down south, they have a care quality commission that's a beefy old boy and can get in and regulate. We have a healthcare improvement Scotland thing that's mostly just encouraging people to get better. So perhaps we need a really toothy regulator as well to go in and investigate the variations in GP practices. Because when you hear stories like the ones I've just given here, the trouble is it erodes confidence unless you know that's not how your GP works, because you know them. When you hear a bad story like that, it erodes trust in the whole GP system, which is not my intention at all, because I'm pretty sure that that is still a real minority. But I'm also pretty sure that wherever you're listening to this from, you know, a practice like this that people are telling you, locals will tell you, do not sign up there. And the folk who are at that practice can't get out because the other practices have closed their lists.
Yeah. I mean, I'm nodding furiously here because there have been some very negative things I know about, and everybody knows about it. You're absolutely, it's the most widely known secret about, you know, A, which practice you don't go to, and B, which doctors you avoid. And you know that people know the situation. I mean, and it's one of those ones where it's, and we cannot separate this out from, again, the decision that's been taken, you know, in terms of the National Health Service by both Labour and Conservative governments, which do have that knock-on effect, even though the health service is devolved up here. I mean, I just took a look at GPs. The latest figures I could get is England, 0.46 GPs per head of population, 1,000 people. Scotland, 0.76. Hooray, we're doing better than England. Aye. Portugal, over 2 GPs per head of population per 1,000. Belgium, 1.15 GPs. You know what I mean? It goes on and on. And in terms of hospitals, Scotland, 2.28 to the latest figures I could get per 1,000. But in comparable EU countries, 3.7. Germany, 4.5 per 1,000. Norway, 5.1. Austria, 5.1. So we're doing appallingly. And the GP numbers have fallen below, in England, the worst case scenario predictions from government advisors in 2015. So it's sitting there. And that debate is actually taking place that you talked about. I mean, within the BMA and the British Medical Journal, there have been debates. And I think Professor Azim Majid, a professor of primary care at Imperial College, has been leading the argument for actually bringing GPs in to the NHS, to removing that sort of, like, you know, it's the Dr. Finlay casebook. You know, you've got your doctor, you've got your GP sitting in the cottage, and Janet is answering the phone for you, and moving it into the 21st century. And it's an oddity that they were left out. They were left out on their own lobbying with an iron Bevan, that GPs weren't brought into the system. And it was vehement lobbying. I mean, and that's where an iron Bevan's comment about the Tories being lower than vermin was to do with the discussions that were taking place there, and the way it was referred to as National Socialism, which was taken up by the British Medical Association at the time. So GPs stayed out with it. But what's also happening down in England, it's in a major knock-on effect here, is the what they call the APMS contract, Alternative Provider of Medical Services, which is allowing all these massive corporations to come in and start to buy up practices. And they're moving away from the partnership model to them being employees, but not employees of the National Health Service, but employees of Virgin Care, employees of all these big medical insurance companies in the United States of America. And that's what's creeping in down south. And
Indeed. And I mean, that was one thing I tweeted there, that I was astonished that the one thing they didn't get into in that excellent Dispatches documentary was any question about the privatisation of the NHS. You know that the structures, it was as if nobody had really gone into any of that to look at the kind of correlation between the difficulties that are arising and the lower provision of all professionals south of the border per head of the population than Scotland, and then all of us way, way, way beyond everybody else, is the tilt towards that kind of private care south of the border. But there is a difficulty that pertains across the whole of Britain and Scotland, which is the fact that many doctors are now becoming part-time.
Yes.
And some of that is because it's a way of them managing the stress of the job, actually. But some of them are becoming part-time and then signing up for locum lists where they can practice temporarily in somebody else's neighbouring practice. And according to someone in the health service I spoke to, just charge extortionate rates. The locums can charge what they like because, you know, obviously there's no solution. The locums are the absolute last stand for the health service when they've got these recurrent problems, including in rural areas where doctors do not want to go. I mean, there's a current, there's all sorts of little projects that the Scottish government's got on the way to try to sweeten the prospect of going to the places that are thin on the ground. And that's laudable. But some of the difficulties I know, again, firsthand from a lot of Highland areas are either because their partners can't get jobs or they can't get housing.
Yeah.
You know, so because it's all been sold off. So we've come to the end of the sort of, you know, society on the cheap model. And we've also come to the end of, I think, of GPs being out with the system and not part of basic NHS workforce planning. But I know saying that there is no more powerful lobby than the than doctors generally and GPs. And as things stand, you know, we're kind of in the middle of an emergency, which is often a pretty difficult time to start shifting things around in a wholesale way. But, you know, I'm sure if somebody was just to start really asking for the evidence of failing practices around Scotland, they would be inundated with particular places that actually the politicians are powerless to deal with.
Yeah. Well, just say the debate is taking place within the medical profession and significant voices are speaking up for bringing the GPs into the system. But I hear my doubts on that. I think that the Conservatives will go down this line of opening up more and opening up more. And say their most recent Health and Social Care Act in 2012, that actually just opened up even more avenues to big business coming in than the Labour legislation in 2004.
The priceless thing will be that as per their usual stuff, they'll say that this is the private sector coming to the rescue.
Yes.
Where essentially the state-led NHS couldn't succeed. I mean, you know.
Oh, yeah. And the big thing about it is there's already been, I mean, this is the whole horrifying thing. They've already been, because they're operating on the profit motive down there, they've already been private enterprise companies that have gone in and because they couldn't cope, have withdrawn, leaving thousands of patients hanging out on a limb, you know, and without any GP coverage at all.
And then you've got to ask where, you know, when the really big issue behind all of this is the overall tranche of funding we are not putting and have never put into health in this country. Where are the parties, the Labour Party principally within the British context, that's standing up to say we need this much more in? And it's true of anything we could go on to discuss here. The, you know, we're fighting on the margins of funding and with a model of low taxation, you know, somehow high wages out of low taxation is Boris Johnson's kind of idea. But as long as you stay with low taxation and with such monies that are obtained going to hopeless kind of causes that nobody supports, like Trident, but also to sort of propping up a systems and preferences and inequality, which Scots do not want, we will never get to the bottom of this beyond just shuggling it around a wee bit.
I like that. Yeah, exactly. It's the shuggling around a wee bit there, yeah, that we've got. I love that. That will be, I think that may be the title of this week's podcast. I think I'll go with that. Yeah, and I'm smiling here because I don't know if you would have heard it yesterday. You heard the noise of the hooters on the river at all, Leslie? I'm just moving on to something hopefully a bit lighter and a bit more local.
Well, I thought that was the unbelievable skeins of geese that are actually going right over my house every day. I mean, every morning, you know, about 8 a.m., there's thousands of them flying actually south. I'm not sure quite where. And then every evening about 6 o'clock, there's this lovely thing of all the gulls basically silently and effortlessly just, as it were, homing their way back up the Tay at about the same time. So, no, I heard no hooters.
Ah, Right. Well, it took me years to realise, by the way, I'll just chip this in here, that Egypt here, I didn't realise that when the geese were flying south, we were south. You know, that was the
so, yeah. I was the same, actually.
I don't feel quite as bad then. But no, what happened was that it was the delivery of the 36-metre whale sculpture to Dundee that arrived at the Stannar Gate. So this guy, Lee Simmons, has created a humpback whale sculpture. I've seen the photographs of it. It looks absolutely tremendous, and it came up from Littlehampton and was delivered. He won the contest to do it, and it's going to be in the Waterfront Place, and it's a multi-sensory experience using both sound and light, and exploring use of an interactive canvas beneath the whale that can respond to users' three-dimensional movements. It looked great. And we've got, my wife has got a family connection to it, because it was the Woods family. It was a fishmonger from the Woods family who actually bought the original tail whale that was washed up. And it was funny when I was thinking about that, you know, and I keep turning around and saying, this is not going to turn into an obituary programme. But there's, you know, we lost Paddy Maloney, we've got David Amos, James Brokenshire, and Ernie Ross, who was my MP in Dundee West for a number of years, and a good man. We lost them, all these folk this week. And it was George Mackay Brown's centenary of his birth this week as well. And you'll probably be familiar with the Year of the Whale, his poem. And I'm going to read a wee bit out of it, which is just reflecting on that whole thing that just was triggered by that. The old go one by one like guttered flames this past winter. Tamag the beeman has taken his cold blank mask to the honeycomb under the hill. Corsten, who ploughed out the moor, unyoked and gone. And I ask, is Heddle lame that in youth could dance and saunter away to the chastest bed? The kirkyard is full of their names, chiselled in stone. Only myself and Yule in the alehouse now speak of the great whale year. So that's in memory of George Mackay Brown. And just a wee thought, again, to return to the beginning, Sir David Amos, reflections and thoughts for his family, and thoughts for everyone who has lost someone recently. So it is a marvellous poem. I recommend it to you if you haven't read the Year of the Whale by George Mackay Brown.
Excellent, Pat. Nice one.
And on that, we'll see you next week, chums.